from the Mutual Broadcasting System. This is STRAT, Strategic Risk Assessment Talk. Now, retired Marine Intelligence Officer and globally recognized risk expert, Hal Kempfer.
Well, I'm glad to have you back on STRAT. I'm going to be talking about a number of different things. Today, I'm going to cover some key issues tied to the global front lines. Of course, the dominant issue and the thing I really have to talk about is the Israel-Iran war. And I don't know any other way to find it. It's a war. I've been asked on the air whether it's a war or not. Is there a formal declaration of war? Ayatollah Khomeini has kind of called it a war. Certainly out of Israel, they're kind of calling it a war. So I'm going to go with every definition that says, yeah, it looks like a war. And they are certainly firing some pretty heavy ordnance at each other. And so that's the term I'm going to use. Now, let me kind of get back on this, because I tell you, a lot of people have kind of forgotten the history. There was a lot of discussion. One of the discussions was that Prime Minister Netanyahu was up for a no-confidence vote, which, as far as I know in Israeli politics, was probably correct. And he was afraid of losing his coalition, all right? His far-right members were going to walk on him, and his government would have collapsed. And if his government collapsed, then he faces the full brunt of the Israeli justice system looking at corruption charges. So that certainly is something I don't discount. However, the actual strikes, if you will, that Israel had when Israel did the airstrikes on Iran, coincided with the end of a 60-day deadline. If you go back a little over 2 months, President Trump had said, look, I'm going to give negotiations with Iran about 60 days to work. And at the very end of those 60 days, even though there was another meeting that had been scheduled with the Iranians, with the U.S. negotiators, that's when the strike took place. So that's something that you certainly can't, nobody can discount. The other thing too, Iran seemed rather, entrenched. They wanted to have their own enrichment capability with uranium. They had significant stocks of uranium at 60%. Doesn't take much to move from 60% to 90%. At 90%, you have weapons-grade uranium, and you can create a nuclear weapon. As of today, the latest I've heard is that Iran was within literally days of being able to create potentially 10 nuclear warheads. And certainly, as everyone has seen with the ballistic missile onslaught from Iran onto Israel, some of those ballistic missiles have gotten through. And you can imagine what would happen if just one nuclear warhead was to get through and hit a major urban area in Israel. And it could be, Mossad, by all reports, had infiltrated, penetrated, whatever you want to call Iran to an extremely high degree. They knew where the leadership figures were. They had excellent intelligence on what was happening in Iran. And certainly I'm inclined to think that a lot of the decision-making was intelligence-driven, if you will, by what they were picking up out of Iran. That Iran may have been hitting that point where they said, maybe things would be easier if we actually had a nuclear weapon in the stockpile. That's, I have to say at this point, without anything further to go on, that's just a supposition, a hypothesis, if you will, but it would certainly be a very solid rationale for Israel to do that. Even if Israel just thought they were going to lean that direction and thought they could do something like that, they were so close to the threshold of being able to create a nuclear warhead that Israel really doesn't have a whole lot of leeway to do that. If Israel was in a position where they looked at all the things lining up on the board in terms of what they could hit, the effect on target, could they potentially stop anything from happening, that has a quality all its own, is when the targets array themselves, if you will, on the battlefield, however you want to define that, in such a way that you recognize this is a unique opportunity to thwart your foe. And so that may have had a quality that I can't discount. Now, on the day the deadline ended, Israel launched a series of airstrikes, reportedly about 200 warplanes were involved. And there was also a series of covert actions, if you will, covert strikes within Iran. By one report, Israel had set up some sort of covert drone base, if you will, not far from Tehran. And they launched drones that were used to go in and hit a number of targets. And in some cases, anti-tank missiles were kind of uniquely used, going after ballistic missiles, air defense, command and control nodes. And obviously, some of those clearly were tied to taking out leadership targets, if you will, Revolutionary Guard Corps targets and others within their military complex, and probably some of those, a number of nuclear scientists that were killed in the initial wave of attack. So it was, I would tell you, if you look at how it was all coordinated, it was nothing less than a brilliant military operation in terms of what they accomplished. Reminds me of what they did in Lebanon going after Hezbollah with the pager attacks, the walkie-talkie attacks, and then some extremely well-targeted airstrikes that basically decimated the leadership of Hezbollah and took that very powerful Iranian proxy organization and has literally knocked it back on its heels to where the government of Lebanon is talking about disarming Hezbollah and it would no longer be a paramilitary force. So that kind of reminds me of what they've done there, following on that. And of course, Hezbollah was their number one proxy. That was kind of the crown jewel, if you will, in the Al-Quds Force proxy network around the world, and they're gone. All right. In that one night, they eliminated a lot of nuclear enrichment capabilities, air defense, ballistic missile capabilities, took out swaths of top Revolutionary Guard Corps and military leadership, and the strikes have continued, and Israel has recently said that this is going to go on for weeks, not days. And that doesn't surprise me. That makes sense because they have kind of hit a strategic inflection point. Once the war kicks off, once this has happened, There is a new calculus, if you will, that the Iranian regime has to go through. And of course, part of that calculus is, will they try to take what they have and accelerate the attempt to build a nuclear warhead? And that is something that Israel has to look at closely. Now, it's worth recounting how Israel has pursued this larger strategy since the deadly October 7th attacks. It's also important to remember, for Israel, October 7th was huge. Israel's a relatively small country. And for Israel, October 7th was kind of a combination of 9/11 and Pearl Harbor, if you will, in terms of what happened to them. I mean, they were caught, you know, talk about strategic surprise. They were caught off guard. They thought they had good defenses around Gaza, and it was just a wholesale slaughter of Israelis and others in Israel that Hamas unleashed. And for Israel, this has had just an incredibly intense, very visceral quality to it. It's difficult to explain just how strong that is. For those of us who recall 9/11 quite vividly and what happened on that day, we recognize what has psychologically and emotionally occurred, certainly with the Israeli public and with Israel. And if you recall, initially, the whole world, all countries around the world, were very much in sympathy and with Israel on what had happened on that. But as Israel pursued retribution, if you will, eliminating the threat, obviously that simpatico feeling has dissipated in some significant corners around the world. Now, we also need to remember that shortly after Hamas did that attack, that Hezbollah weighed in and started firing missiles into Israel. And there was this missile thing with missiles coming out of Gaza, missiles coming down Lebanon, both Hamas and Hezbollah, and the concern being that Hezbollah was going to launch this massive missile onslaught, this onslaught, if you will, hitting Israeli cities, and that it was going to immediately be this massive two-front war. The Hezbollah thing always seemed to be kind of holding back a little bit, and I think they realized that they may have been a little overstretched in terms of what they tried to do, and so they never actually did that. But Hezbollah was very much seen as a party to this. And of course, both of those things, both Hamas and Hezbollah, are Iranian proxies. They are military groups, terrorist groups, paramilitary groups, whatever you want to call them, that are trained by, backed by, financed by, everything by the Iranian government and the Revolutionary Guard Corps and its Al-Quds element of the Revolutionary Guard Corps. So there was no ambiguity in what was going on there. Also, the Houthis down in Yemen are another proxy of Iran, again, backed by, financed by, armed by, everything by Iran. And not too long afterwards, they basically corked up shipping going through the Gulf of Aden, the Red Sea, the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, with drone attacks, missile attacks, even a commando attack on a ship that was rather spectacular. And you really got the sense of this Iran using its proxies in a concerted effort. And eventually, the Houthis were even firing drones and missiles into Israel itself as part of this. So you had all the Iranian proxies attacking Israel and causing major mayhem if you will, in global supply chains and shipping and just causing massive disruption. And of course, for Egypt, where the Suez Canal is one of the major, not just one of the major arteries, but it's also a major, major source of revenue for the government of Egypt. It dropped like 50% and then more in terms of what was going through the Suez Canal, because shipping wasn't going through the Suez Canal because it couldn't go through the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, it couldn't go through the Red Sea, couldn't go through the Gulf of Aden. And ships were having to divert all around the Horn of Africa. It has been a mess. It has put enormous economic, political strain on Egypt. It has caused tremendous economic strain on Europe. The reaction of the United States has been to put naval task forces in there to attack the Houthis, and that's been an ongoing effort with major attacks going there. The British, don't forget, also were attacking the Houthis, and Israel has been doing airstrikes attacking the Houthis. And more recently, they did a naval attack on the biggest port that the Houthis have, actually harkening back almost to another age. But they launched a big attack from the sea. I think that was to make a huge statement. We've also seen what's happened in Gaza. Gaza has essentially been destroyed, if you will, and going after Hamas. And Hamas has shown a callous disregard, certainly for the well-being of the Palestinian residents in Gaza. Of course, Israel's taken tremendous criticism for the way it has prosecuted going after Hamas in there. But I would also reference that Hamas is still holding Israeli hostages. And whereas there have been some releases of Israeli hostages, Hamas has been rather intransigent in trying to find a workable end state, if you will, in terms of getting hostages out and everything else. In Lebanon, Israel went into southern Lebanon. They reduced a lot of Hezbollah targets. They kind of came to an agreement, if you will, with Hezbollah, basically resecuring a zone that had been previously agreed upon, although Hezbollah apparently was trying to infiltrate that. Now, this was an area that theoretically was being overseen. There were peacekeeping forces by the United Nations and by the government of Lebanon that were in that area. And as Israel went in there, they found weapons caches and everything else that Hezbollah, and it was all, they already knew Hezbollah had been operating fairly freely in this area, but it kind of removed the facade that there was some sort of peacekeeping presence in southern Lebanon that was actually doing anything other than letting Hezbollah run amok. Don't forget, the Assad government has fallen in Syria. Of course, that creates another dynamic where the leader, the primary leader of the HTS faction, which is now the government of Syria, that removed Assad, is a former al-Qaeda operative, no less. Although the U.S., he met with President Trump, and the U.S. is basically normalizing relations with Syria. And that's one of the great experiments, if you see, in diplomacy, if you will, kind of on, in some ways, some have said it's like Nixon going to China, if you will. It's certainly very unusual. And so anyway, since June 14th, there's been a lot of back and forth. The nature of the strikes, the Israel's had their taking out nuclear facilities, taking out leadership positions, taking out all sorts of military stuff. Israel has now achieved what air superiority. I think they're going to move to what's air supremacy, which is they have, and some would say over the skies of Tehran, they already have that, which is they pretty much have unrestricted air capability, if you will. They can just fly all over Iran and hit whatever they want. And that's a good reason why you're seeing this take weeks. Iran is a really, really big country. There are a lot of targets, if you will, that Israel is going to have to deal with. It's not something where they can go in there and just hit it with a strike and then run away and say, we're done. They've got to hit a lot of things, and they have got to have effect on target, eliminating those facilities from being threats. It also has a huge psychological impact. The Khomeini government is this autocratic theocracy, is deeply unpopular with the Iranian people. And I think 80%, maybe 90% of the population does not support them. Of course, under attack, the natural reaction of any national group is to rally around the flag, if you will, to a certain degree. But Israel has been working on this for quite some time. They've had this plan for quite some time. They've obviously got connections with the opposition. I'm just going to assume that would seem to be a pretty safe bet. And so certainly they are working to try and remove this government, and they very well could end up removing this government. I think that is not an impossibility. Some would say I'm being a little optimistic that this government would end, certainly from a U.S. and certainly from the perspective of a Marine who saw what happened in 1983 in Beirut. You know, the first person I knew that was killed in a terrorist attack was in the Beirut airport bombing in 1983. you know, someone I was in officer candidate school with way back when. And so obviously, I've got a, let's just say, a lot of payback that aims in the direction of Iran going back a very, very long way. Now, will the Iranian population overthrow the regime? That is a big question. Netanyahu has indicated that he may, you know, he kind of left it wide open. They said, is he going to assassinate Khamenei? I don't assassinate, target, whatever you want to say. I think that's a very distinct possibility that that could happen. So I'm going to put that out there, that could happen, and that may be the end state on this thing. But the bottom line is this. Israel is a small country. It's about the size of New Jersey, and they cannot afford to have one nuclear detonation in their territory. They've only got a few big cities, or larger cities, I should say. One Hiroshima-type detonation in Tel Aviv would have catastrophic effects on the nation state of Israel. So there is kind of an absolutist doctrine that they have to pursue, which they just can't let anybody have that. The other thing, too, is if you look historically, Syria tried to develop a nuclear weapon. Iraq tried to develop a nuclear weapon. Libya tried to develop a nuclear weapon. A number of enemies of Israel over the years have all tried to develop nuclear weapons. Also, do not forget the game the United Nations, the U.S., others were playing with North Korea for years, where they're trying to incentivize them not to develop a nuclear weapon. And it didn't work because North Korea went ahead and developed a nuclear weapon and now may have as many as 50 nuclear warheads in their inventory, completely changing the strategic math in East Asia. South Korea is sitting there under the, you know, quote, U.S. nuclear umbrella, wondering just how strong that nuclear umbrella is, wondering if the U.S. would be willing to respond to a North Korean nuclear attack with nuclear weapons, and in doing so, potentially put at risk U.S. cities in the Pacific and the West Coast. That has got to be a big question. Japan's asking that same question now, too. So that's something that kind of weighs in the background on all of this. All right, so that's on that. Now, finally, California National Guard federalization. I've kind of addressed this a little bit before, but it's worth recounting. President Trump mobilized 4,000 California National Guard troops under Title 10 federal authority. He also has deployed 700 Marines into Los Angeles, and they are right now providing security to federal buildings and to federal law enforcement personnel engaged in raids on illegal immigration throughout Southern California. Most of them are really, as far as I can tell, are just guarding buildings. They are a very well-equipped, very well-trained security force. Let's just put it that way. Obviously, Governor Gavin Newsom, Mayor Karen Bass are really not thrilled about this, very angry about it, and Gavin Newsom's been going to court to try and stop this. Now, there has been some interesting discussion that the president can't do this, that he has to ask permission of the governor to do this, and the courts are going to rule on this. I may be wrong, but I don't know of anything that says the president, normally they'll coordinate with the states and they'll say, hey, we're going to activate your guard. And we've done that historically. In the global war on terror, the Department of Defense was activating National Guard units on a regular rotation all around the country and putting them on rotations in Afghanistan, Iraq, and other countries around the world, other places that they had to go. Pete Hegseth himself was a member of the National Guard. He deployed multiple times in federal status. And so it's not a new thing to be done. And if you go back to World War II, you know, we just recently celebrated the anniversary of the landings at Normandy. And if you look at Normandy, a lot of those, you know, a number of the divisions were National Guard divisions, essentially. Those, by 1944, we had federalized, activated all these National Guard things. We trained the heck out of them. And so the National Guard was in their federal army status, and nobody really thinks of those divisions as National Guard divisions, are just army divisions, all right? So there isn't really anything in there. Now, the National Guard goes back a long way. It actually goes back before the Revolution, the state militias, if you will, which were often volunteers that simply raised their right hand, and they knew how to fire a rifle, and they'd teach them a little close-order drill, how to march, and some very basic tactics, and they'd march them off to war. And that was where that whole thing came from. And it kind of stayed that way for a long period of time. Now, really up to the Spanish-American War. And if you remember Teddy Roosevelt's Rough Riders, my great-grandfather was a member of the, I think it was the Iowa State Volunteers or Iowa State Militia. And they were activated, part of the army, and went in to the Philippines as part of the Spanish-American War. So there's a long history of that. But after the Spanish-American War, we really started professionalizing the military across the board. And we also professionalized the training, readiness, equipping of the National Guard units. And so they were put into regular formations. They were built into the larger national defense structure of the United States. This definitely was the case going into World War II, and after World War II and the Cold War, there was a very defined structure. And they were basically, they were federal military assets, although when not in their federal status, the states could use them. The governors could use them for a variety of things like disaster relief, emergency use, all sorts of different things. All right. But I don't recall anything that said that the president has to get the permission of the governor to federalize them. That's just something that's rather interesting that was out there. Now, the federal military is a little more restricted. When the National Guard troops are in state status under the governor's authority, they can do law enforcement in, I think, pretty much all the states, or maybe some states that have exceptions. But under the federal system, they're controlled under what's called posse comitatus, which says federal troops cannot do law enforcement. This was something that was during the Reconstruction period after the Civil War. Federal troops were doing law enforcement because in the former Confederate states, law enforcement was not doing law enforcement. Law enforcement was basically supporting this racist, neo-Confederate sort of thing, trying to impose what eventually became the Jim Crow laws, but doing all sorts of horrific things. And the federal troops would go down there to basically make sure that all the freedoms, all the rights of African Americans following the Civil War were being enforced. Eventually, the Confederate States got enough steam in Congress that they got the Posse Comitatus Act passed, and that ended federal military law enforcement. But actually, if you go back to that period, federal military, you know, there is a revisionist thought. It's like, oh, those excesses of the military and blah, blah, blah. And I hear that sometimes. It's like, it wasn't so much excesses of the military. It was that these racist, you know, Confederate losers didn't like the federal military basically enforcing the law. And the federal military is very effective doing that. So I want to put a little historical footnote on that because I often hear it briefed the wrong way. That's actually where it came from. Now, if the president was to declare the Insurrection Act, basically saying that there's an insurrection, that the local, state, local authorities have lost control, then Posse Comitatus could be put aside and federal troops could do law enforcement in that area because there is no other way to maintain law and order and to protect the citizenry than to have the military do that. President Trump has not declared the Insurrection Act, and federal troops have been used for security missions going back long into history. It was used for security missions, securing the mails back in the 1920s, but federal troops have been used for security all the time, so that's not a really radical mission. So, now, I saw a memo that was put out by the Cal Guard, the California Guard, and it says State Guard, and I think what they're talking about is what used to be called the State Military Reserve. These are troops that cannot be brought into federal status. I think that's what it is, but it was very ambiguously written, and I wasn't sure if it was addressing just State Guard or all Guard troops that were not currently federalized. I don't know, but it basically was saying that the troops just stand down. Don't go to the armories, don't go to the bases. They don't have a lot of bases, but there are some National Guard bases in California. And it said, just don't go to them. And I'm sure that this is Governor Gavin Newsom trying to avoid a confrontation with these guard unit or guard personnel or guard units with protesters, particularly violent protesters. And that seems like a logical inference from that. But it also interestingly implies that the security situation, and I don't know if they really thought this through, but it definitely applies. It puts in writing saying, hey, things are so bad that these guard units can't go. Now, the issue is if the units and personnel they're talking about are National Guard personnel who can be federally recognized, this means they're saying they can't go to their designated bases and armories to conduct federal military training that's paid for with what's called Title 32, which is a federal funding source that pays for the National Guard to do training so they can pursue their their federal, dare I say, warfighting mission as part of our national defense structure. That's interesting. And I don't know how that will be interpreted. But if you're trying to provide an excuse for the president to reconsider the Insurrection Act, I think they sent him a memo, which gave him a lot to mull over in that regard. It also would probably make some think out there, what is the status of the California National Guard? Is the governor going to hold them back? Now, I want to point out something. The president federalizing the Guard has been used in ways that have irritated governors before. Specifically, when the court said that the University of Alabama in this early 60s had to integrate and that African-American students could go onto the campus and take classes, and federal marshals were sent to escort them onto the campus. Governor George Wallace called out the National Guard under state status and lined them up in front of the school to block the federal marshals and those students from coming on campus. And my recollection was President Kennedy federalized the Guard and said, okay, you're now a federal asset. And the commander of the Guard turned to the governor and said, sir, I no longer work for you. The Guard stood aside, and the students and the marshals went onto the campus, and the University of Alabama was integrated. All right, that's one of the great moments, I think, in civil rights history in the United States, and that was a president federalizing the National Guard over the objections of the governor. And I would point that out as history. You know, one would say, well, that was a different situation. Different situation, same authority, same thing. Yeah, and whereas a lot of people don't like it, what's happening now, I would say yes, but trust me, George Wallace and a lot of those, segregationists in Alabama didn't like it either, but that's how the system works. All right, so anyway, a lot to discuss or a lot to mull over and a lot to think about. Thanks for listening to Strat. I hope you go to Hal Kempfer TV, and I certainly hope you go to stratpodcast.com, and some of you may be actually seeing this on stratpodcast.com. And thanks again, and we'll have more Strat episodes coming up.